Hi, and welcome to the ProPublica podcast. I'm Heather Vogel, an investigative reporter at ProPublica who writes about education, and I'm talking today with Annie Waldman. Annie also covers education here, and she recently wrote a story we co-published with the New York Times about New Jersey's student loan program. The program has been called state-sanctioned loan sharking by a bankruptcy lawyer and has been criticized by borrowers for high interest rates, inflexible payment plans, and aggressive debt collection tactics. Thanks, Annie, for talking with me about your story about New Jersey's student loan program.
Thanks for having me on.
Can you tell me a little bit about why you started looking into this agency and its loan program?
Yeah, so last year, CC Bay and I finished a large student debt project. And in the wake of that project, somebody had told me, oh, you're looking at federal loans? You should really look at state private loans. And I actually thought that the person didn't know what they were talking about. I didn't realize that states had private loan programs, so I forgot about it for a while. And then several months later, I was looking through the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau database of complaints. And these complaints relate to things from car loans to payday loans to bank loans, but they also have student loan complaints in there. And what I noticed was that a bunch of states had accumulated a number of complaints over a couple years. And New Jersey had more complaints than any other state. And that really sparked my interest. And I started to think, why did they have complaints? What was the state program? How were they involved in the student loan sphere? And that's when I decided this deserves a closer look and a little more attention. And that's how I got into it.
Tell me a little bit more about who is taking these loans out and why. Why are federal loans not adequate to cover the costs of higher education today?
So federal loans, for the most part, only cover $31,000 for 4 years, or 5 years even, which is very little if you look at the cost of tuition these days. Even with state schools, if you look at Rutgers, for example, Rutgers can cost $80,000 over 4 years. So $31,000 of federal loans is just not going to be enough to cover it. So most students will get some kind of grants or scholarships or federal grants or turn to their parents, but a lot of middle-class families really do have to turn to the private loan market in order to supplement those federal loans.
Now, what was a moment when you knew you had a story versus just something interesting that you were taking a closer look at? When did you know you had a story about New Jersey?
So after I looked at the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau complaints, I looked at another database. Paul Keel and I had worked on a story about wage garnishment, and I had a database of every single lawsuit in New Jersey over debt. And so I looked at the complaints, and I was like, well, maybe this agency will appear in this other lawsuit database. And I looked up New Jersey and realized that the number of lawsuits 5 years ago was under 100. And then 5 years later, they had over 1,500 lawsuits. And I thought that this had to be a fluke. Perhaps something was wrong with our data. But then I actually re-scraped the entire database from the New Jersey court system and found that indeed New Jersey was suing students way more than they were 5 years ago. And that's when I knew, you know, if they were as aggressive as this, they deserved more attention.
So these voluminous lawsuits filed by New Jersey's Higher Education Student Assistance Authority ended up really being a treasure trove for your reporting. Can you talk a little bit more about how you used them when you started reading them and maybe putting them in a database or analyzing them?
Yeah. So after I scraped every single lawsuit, I used this almost as a source list. So I had the name of every individual who had been sued. I had their lawyer if they had any. And for some of the cases, I even had the amount of money that they were being sued over. And I had the city where they lived. So using their name and the city where they lived, I was able to track down a number of families and just call them up at random and have that awkward conversation where they think I'm a debt collector when I first call, because I'm like, hello, can I talk to you about New Jersey class loans and the Higher Education Student Assistance Authority? And after some convincing, many families were able to feel a little more comfortable with me and talk more about their debt.
We're going to talk a little bit more in a minute or two about two of the main characters in the story that was published by ProPublica and the New York Times. But tell me just a little bit more about the snapshots you were getting from social media and from the lawsuits. Were there certain patterns that were emerging? And what were some of the things that really made your jaw drop that you were hearing from people?
One of the things that was so astounding was that so many students were going into default, meaning that they had spent 6 months not paying their bills or falling behind on their bills or struggling to pay their bills. And then they were literally put into this category called default. And once you default with one of these loans, the agency cuts off all contact with you. They stop answering your phone calls. They stop answering your emails. They say you have to now communicate with collection firms. And for a lot of students who believed this was a state program, who believed this was something that they could trust, they were shocked that their state would turn their backs on them like that. And that was, I guess, the most consistent feeling that I got from all families that I spoke with, was that this is a state agency. On the website of the state agency, there is a portrait of Chris Christie. There's the seal of the state. They say in quotations on their brochures that their students are their number one responsibility, their number one thing that they focus on. Yet, when students struggle, when they default, the agency turns their back on these students. So that was this feeling that families had of being tricked or being misled. That was just the through line throughout everybody's story.
So people felt that by taking out a New Jersey loan, that they were going to be given something that was more consumer friendly, more transparent, and more in their interest than something from a private bank, for instance. And that was very different from what their experience was.
Exactly. And one of the most, I guess you could say, shocking things that I heard from a lot of families is that this loan was advertised to them in high schools. So this agency, they have multiple responsibilities. They give out these loans, but they also have financial aid nights in high schools across the state. And in these financial aid nights and in their PowerPoints, which I looked at, they advertise their loan right alongside the federal options. So for many families who they might be sending a kid to college for the first time, the kid might be the first kid in their family to go to college, maybe they didn't go to college, maybe they don't have experience with tuition or college debt, they don't know the difference between this. There's not enough financial awareness or understanding of the huge implications of taking out loans and different types of loans. And so they trusted these state individuals, these individuals who are representing an agency of the state, to help them make their decisions.
And what kind of counseling comes along with this sort of debt? Were there resources that this agency offered to families, or were they supposed to be looking to people in their public schools, or how were they supposed to be finding out information, and was that inadequate?
Yeah, so a lot of the students that I spoke with found out the information about the loan and other resources through advisors at the colleges themselves, but also through people in the agency. But the agency has said that they advise borrowers or they counsel borrowers before they take out the loan. And one thing that was consistent with everybody that I spoke with is that nobody actually spoke with somebody on the phone from this agency and gave them their situation. This is how much money my family makes. This is what I'm majoring in. This is what I want to do with my life. I didn't hear that there was really any direct communication between the agency and the students in that way. And a lot of people told me that they applied for these loans online. It took them 15 minutes to fill out the application, and within an hour, they were approved.
That's
amazing. Which is a really fast turnaround. I mean, I don't think you could get a mortgage that quickly.
Wow. So tell me a little bit about the mother that had the tragic loss of her son happen. It's sort of in the middle of his having taken out these loans and the family looking to pay them back. And what happened to them?
So Marcia de Oliveira Longanetti, her son was murdered. He had taken a break from school. He had finished 3 years. He took a year off and he was going to go back for his final year. And a couple weeks before classes were set to begin, he was murdered. He was found shot in the head in the doorway of his house. And after you lose a child, I mean, as Marcia described it to me, her life just became a blur. I mean, she had to focus on so many other things other than his student loans. And a couple months afterwards, she then got notices about his student loans that they weren't being paid. And so she called up first the administrators of the federal loan, and she asked them, you know, she told them her son had been murdered. She was dealing with so many things related to his death. And they just told her, don't worry about it. Like, your loans will be forgiven. We'll handle this. And it was easy as that. Then she turned to the state expecting the same thing, because she expected that the state, as a part of the government, would have the same policies and would be compassionate, thinking of the families first, essentially. And when she called the state, they said, okay, send us your income information, send us your house information, send us all of this stuff. We want to send us your tax information. We want to know how much money you have first. And so she sent in, you know, her tax information, and her husband, they don't make a lot of money. I mean, they're a middle class family, but, you know, she's a nanny part time. She cleans houses part time. Her husband is a landscaper. They're by no means rolling in dough. And so she sent in this information, and the state agency sent her a letter back and said, we looked at all of your information and you don't fit the criteria for forgiveness. So we're going to continue to send you bills, which she was shocked. I mean, she was shocked and confused. This is a state agency. How could they do this to her family? But to this day, she's been continuing to pay off his loans. She's made 17 payments since he died at $180 a month, and she'll continue to do that for the next 6 or 7 years.
Wow. Another character in your story is Chris Gonzalez. Can you tell us a little bit about what happened to him?
Chris, when he graduated, he took out $180,000 from the state of New Jersey for his student loans. He went to Embry-Riddle University in Florida. He did 5 years of school. He took out some federal loans. He actually took out some Citibank loans as well, or private bank loans. But the majority of his tuition was backed by these New Jersey state loans. And after he graduated, things looked up. You know, he got a job at Goldman Sachs. He studied programming. He was doing really well. He was working in Wall Street and downtown New York. 6 months after he started his job, rashes began to appear all over his body. And he went to a dermatologist. He went to several doctors. And turns out they had non-Hodgkin's lymphoma and that he would have to do cancer treatment twice a week for at least the upcoming year. So he struggled with the cancer treatment, his job for 3.5 years, 4 years. And then, unfortunately, he was let go from his job. So he contacted the agency and he said, you know, I can't afford this. You know, I just lost my job. I still have my cancer treatment that I'm going through. At that point, it was only once every other week. And he just wanted to defer his loan so he'd have no payments for 6 months at least so he could get back on his feet. And the agency said, $500 is the least that we could ask. That is how much we want from you. We can't go lower than that. And he sent them an email and he said, my health insurance is $200 a month. I could forego that and give it to you. Would that work? And they said, they responded that no, we suggest that you default. We suggest that we send your account to collections. And then that was that. They sent it to collections. He couldn't afford it, so they wouldn't move for him. They wouldn't budge for him. And now he's being sued by the Higher Education Student Assistance Authority for $266,000. So even though his loans were only $188,000, they tacked on interest and also lawyer's fees of around $40,000.
Can you talk a little bit about how in both of those, you've touched on it a bit, but just to emphasize that the situations that both those families encountered, while unusual, were handled differently by the federal loan program. So just to bring, you know, that contrast a little bit to the forefront.
So the federal government, if you have a child that dies, and let's just say you took out Parent PLUS loans, which that is under the name of the parent, it's not under the name of the child. Even though that loan is under your name, the federal government will forgive that loan. And in fact, a lot of state agencies also do this. New Jersey is not the only state agency that gives out private loans. There are around 20 other state-based programs, and half of them forgive the loans if a child dies, even if somebody else co-signed, including the next largest loan program, which is Massachusetts, with an outstanding loan portfolio of around $1.3 billion. They forgive the loans for the parents who co-signed if a child dies. So what you start to see is there is some kind of inequity. Even if, you know, they sign that contract, they're legally obligated as a co-signer to pay off those loans if their child dies or their child is unable to pay it. You know, other states and also the federal government handle it very differently.
So the main issues that were tripping families up that you were hearing, it was also a high interest rate, the inflexible repayment plans, and a lack of caps on the loans. That was another feature of these loans that differed from some of the other states you looked at, right? People could just take out huge amounts of loans.
Right.
Was there anything else that was particularly troublesome about these loans or that set them apart for consumers?
Yeah. I mean, the one thing that I think was so shocking for me was that these loans, even though they're literally private loans, I mean, students who take out these loans have to fill out a disclosure form that says private education loan at the top. It's required under Dodd-Frank and Truth in Lending Act. So despite this fact, the agency has the powers of the state when they want to compel families to pay, which means that they can garnish your wages, they can seize your wages without a court judgment, even before you default on your loans. They can also suspend any kind of professional license or revoke any kind of professional license if you default. For example, if you're a doctor or if you're a nurse, you can have your license taken away. They can also take away your lottery winnings. If you win more than $1,000, they can take away your lottery winnings. And on top of that, they can also take away your state tax return, which a lot of families will rely on at the end of the year.
So now that you've figured out that there's a problem with these loans, you start looking into why. What did you discover about how these loans are set up and the role of Wall Street? What's behind some of the inflexibility?
So when I started to look at these loans, one of the prime documents that I used were the bond indentures. These loans, the way that they're set up is that they're not backed by taxpayer dollars. These loans are not paid by taxpayer dollars at all. They're actually paid by bonds, which are sold to Wall Street investors, to bondholders, who the agency is responsible for paying back.
So at the center of all of this is the New Jersey authority that's charged with administering these loans. What did you find out about the people who were making decisions about the loan program?
So what I found out was essentially that even though it's an independent authority, like the Port Authority, it's separate from the state, a lot of the individuals who are at the top, who are making the decisions, are very much directly connected to the governorship. So at this time, it's Chris Christie. He has the power to appoint the executive director, who should serve at the pleasure of the governor, according to the law. He also has the power to appoint 12 of the 18 board members. And most importantly, I believe, he has the power to veto any meeting minutes. So any actions that are voted on at the meetings, any decisions that are made at the meetings, he can veto them, and the meetings have to come back together and make new laws. So really, even though he has said to us, and he told us directly, that he has no control over this agency, the agency does indirectly answer to him.
Right. So now the agency is also very dependent on revenue directly from these loans, correct?
Yeah, about half of the administrative budget comes from these loans.
Versus having those funds come from the state's budget, the state's general fund. And what are the implications of that?
Well, I asked the agency about this. I asked them, because half of your administrative budget relies on the revenue from these loans, what would happen if you didn't have this program? How would it affect the agency? And they told me that it wouldn't affect them, which was kind of shocking for me. I mean, their budget is around $28 million a year for 150 people who work there, and about $14 million of that budget come directly from revenue from the loan program, which includes collections, origination fees, any other revenue that comes out of that.
Did you pinpoint a change in how aggressive the agency was in lending or collections in recent years? And what did you end up deciding you thought drove that?
As I said before, when I looked at these lawsuits that were being filed, there seemed to be a direct change in 2010. And at the same time, I looked at the amount of loans that were given out, the sheer sum of loans that were given out, and that changed around 2007, 2008, 2009. And so 2010, like 2009, 2010 seemed to be a real time period of change for this entire loan program. So then I started to look at the larger context. What was happening in the national loan landscape during that time? And what happened between 2005 to 2010 was that the government, which had originally relied on these state-based guarantee agencies in order to kind of back or insure federal loans, decided to cut off this entire program, eliminate this entire program, and cut out these state-based agencies and start to do direct lending to students. And so the state agencies, which had normally been such an integral part of the federal student aid program and federal student loans, all of a sudden lost a lot of revenue and lost a lot of connection to the federal government and in a lot of ways lost their identity. I mean, this was an existential crisis for many of these state-based agencies across the country. I mean, California's agency decided to transfer all of the federal loans which they were responsible to and kind of close up shop. Other state-based agencies also took on different responsibilities. For example, Pennsylvania's decided to get contracts from the federal government to help with this direct loan program. New Jersey, unfortunately, didn't get those contracts. They transferred some of their loans. But what they did during this time period was that they seemed that they were escalating their private loan program as a way to make up for that. And when I asked the agency about this, they said that, no, that was not the case. They said that it was tuition went up and enrollment in schools went up, and that was what was really driving the growth in their program. However, when I looked at tuition in New Jersey and enrollment in New Jersey of colleges, I mean, it did not grow at the same pace as their loan program.
Hmm. Now, what was the response of the agency to your questions overall about its loan program? You attempted to contact them early on for an interview, right? And kind of what happened?
So I started really diving into this story in January. And in, I believe it was March, is when I started to contact this agency. And I asked them for an interview over email. I called and spoke with the communications person there. And they denied me an interview several times. So then I decided, well, maybe I can go to their board meeting and I can talk to some board members. And maybe they'll feel like I'm more committed to the story. I'm there. You know, they can give me an interview. And even when I went there, no board members would speak with me. The agency wouldn't speak with me. They declined an interview again. And so eventually it just got to the point where I had to email them my questions and get their responses. But even with my follow-up questions, they did not respond to my email for them.
Talk a little bit about your efforts to pin down what should have been a fairly simple statistic, which was the default rate for these loans.
So the way that we look at federal loans and the strength of federal loans is through this thing called the cohort default rate, which is essentially looking at the cohort of students who graduate 2 years after, 3 years after, 5 years after graduating, how many of those students have defaulted on their loans. It's a very normal number. Lots of people use it. We use it for many federal laws. So I figured this agency would have it. Turns out that they don't track their loans using a cohort default rate. They don't look at these cohort default rates at all. But when I asked for the cohort default rate, they reached out to their bondholders, essentially Bank of America, who sent them an email with their cohort default rates. But the one caveat of the cohort default rates, which they sent to me, were that they were only of students whose credit rating was above 670. So these were all students who had a relatively strong credit rating, even though a lot of these loans were given to families who had lower credit ratings. So it seemed to me that they were, I don't know if it's intentional, but they weren't giving me the whole story.
It could result in cherry picking, essentially. The borrowers who are more likely to pay back.
Yeah, and I asked them for the cohort default rates of all students, not just the ones who had stronger credit scores, and I did not hear back from them.
What was the reaction from the agency after you published the story and also from readers?
So I have not heard from the agency yet, but from readers, there's always two sides when you publish. There's the people who this is a story that really affects them personally, or they feel affected by it, or it hits a nerve, you know, about student debt just generally. And I've heard that they're very grateful for the story. But then there's other people who, you know, responded in ways which I respect, which is that in Marcia's case, for example, she co-signed on the loan, so she's legally bound to them. Or with the fact that a lot of people believe that all students should take out life insurance when they take on student loans because of the risk involved with these loans, because there's no other collateral, so it can really affect your entire family. But I think the most important thing to remember at the end of the day is that we're not talking about private loans from banks. We're talking about state programs, state-based programs, government programs, which are not offering their citizens the same protections as the federal government. And we really have to ask ourselves, is that a country that we want to live in?
Thanks very much for talking with me, Annie.
Thanks.
Thanks for joining us, and be sure to tune in next week.